Hello and welcome to the Asian Society of International Law 101, a space where we discuss international law scholarship from Asia, about Asia, and international law scholarship in general.
We're very fortunate to have with us today Indai Sajor, who was one of the key organizers of the 2000 Tokyo Women's Tribunal, and who has had intensive work and research experience on human rights and social justice issues. The Tokyo Women's Tribunal was a people's tribunal organized by activists and victim survivors of the system of sexual slavery organized by the Japanese military during World War II. The tribunal drew on and contributed to a rich heritage and practice of people's tribunals. It has been one of the most impactful with its findings cited and shaping the work of numerous international and domestic bodies. Good evening, Indai. Thank you for taking the time to chat with us. Really appreciate it, given the time difference. And I know it's currently night over there. So I was wondering if we could use your publication, Put Wrong on the Scaffold and Truth on the Throne, as a starting point. In this piece, where you discussed the work of the tribunal, you explained that the tribunal was a culmination of more than a decade of work and sacrifice of survivors. Could you talk about the idea, how the idea to hold a people's tribunal within the movement began?
Yes. Well, first of all, thank you, Chia, for inviting me. And I'm really glad to be able to speak to your class and talk about the importance of the Tokyo Women's Tribunal. So I think I would like to start in way back in the 90s, you know, in 1990, 91, 92. That was the height of the international women's rights movement globally. And even in Asia, we were one of the key players in putting forward women's rights as human rights. And so this international networking has actually catapulted our work at the national level to the global level. And during this period, and that was in 1991, I was with the Asian Center for Women's Human Rights. I was a co-director. We had an office in India and an office in Manila. And our theme then was to promote women's human rights. And one of the issues that we were encountering then was the issue of sex trafficking, the issue of rape. And in 1992, I was in South Korea attending a conference on self-trafficking. And there, the first Korean comfort woman came out during our conference. Her name was Kim Hak-soo. And she was the first one to come out. We didn't know the existence of the comfort women, but we knew that women were raped during the Second World War. My mother and our grandmother did talk about that, but we never knew the existence of a comfort woman. So when Kim Hak-soo started to come out in media, I was in Seoul, Korea at the time, together with my colleague. And we realized that if this happened in South Korea, you know, we were part of the victimized countries, the Philippines, and maybe there were some women who were like here. So in 1992, when we went back to the Philippines after that conference, we went on the radio and we asked if there are any women who was raped during the Second World War to contact our office. And that was the beginning of the comfort women in the Philippines coming out to tell their story. So Lola Rosa Henson, she was the first Filipina to come out and tell her story. And of course, you know, she became immediately a media hit and, you know, people started interviewing her. And that is when the consciousness of what sexual slavery was all about. But I would like to point out that at that time, we didn't even call it yet sexual slavery, because one of the contributions of the comfort women was we codified sexual slavery at the United Nations. And I remembered Etsuru Tetsuka. He was a wonderful Japanese lawyer who supported us. And she said, you know, this issue of women being repeatedly raped inside the comfort station, that is actually sexual slavery. And then we started introducing the term sexual slavery to the Commission on Human Rights in Geneva. So I would just like to take note that the name and then the word sexual slavery was actually coined due to the testimonies of the comfort women. And so this is very important for you to understand that a lot of these issues came out of the testimonies of the comfort women. So the movement started when the South Korean came out, and then the Filipino comfort women came out, and then this has become an international issue. And then Jan O'Hearn, she was a Dutch woman who was in Indonesia. You know, Indonesia was a colony of the Netherlands. She was in Indonesia during the Second World War, and she was also raped and brought into the so-called comfort station. Now, let me discuss briefly what the comfort station is, and then I'll go back to the movement aspect. A comfort station, they call it the comfort station, is because women were brought inside a building with different rooms, and women were put inside the room, and the Japanese soldiers would line up and rape the women. So that essence of, you know, rape not only one time, but another soldier would come in once another soldier would come out. And that was the essence of what a comfort station and the comfort women came about. So then the Chinese comfort women came out, and then the North Korean comfort women came out. So in 1993, we had the very first public hearing, you know, of these women coming from different countries, basically the Philippines, the Dutch women from the Netherlands, who was actually living in Australia by then, and then of course the North Korean, the South Korean, and then the Chinese comfort women. So we all met in Tokyo in a public hearing that really put the issue and highlighted internationally because the media was there. This was the beginning of what I would say, the international women's rights networking, or as you would call it, the transnational feminism networking. Because then all the women around the world during this period started to say, what happened? Why did this happen? You know, why it took the women 50 years to come out? The significance of this is very important. The first Tokyo public hearing on the comfort women was done in 1993. But remember that the first world conference on human rights was done in Vienna in 1993. And it was only then that the United Nations recognized women's rights as human rights, only in 1993. And because of the lobbying of the women, yeah, it was us women and the women's movement from Malaysia, Singapore, we were all there, Africa, the Middle East. We went to Vienna and said, you have to recognize women's human rights as human rights. And for the first time, we brought a Korean comfort woman to Vienna to testify of what happened to her during the Second World War. So that was the biggest impact, I think, in terms of the recognition of the comfort women issue, because it inspired the women from the former Yugoslavia, because remember there was a war in the former Yugoslavia in 1990, to also come out because they heard the testimonies of the comfort women. It gave them the courage to come out as well, and they also testified in Vienna. Now, this is where, as you know, we would say the transnational, you know, women's movement comes about. And really in Asia, we became a movement that really catapulted the issue of the comfort women to that level.
Thank you so much, Indai. That was really fascinating. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about the challenges that you experienced organizing the tribunal and what are the challenges encountered at a domestic level as well as across borders?
Yeah, well, it is really very challenging because remember, you know, the comfort women in nine countries came out. You know? So as I have said, you know, you have North and South Korea, you have China, you have Taiwan, then the Philippines, then you have Indonesia, Malaysia, and then East Timor, and the Netherlands. You know, those were the comfort women from these countries who really came out and testified. You know, they were there in flesh and talking about their experiences. And behind each woman were women's organizations in that country that supported her. So it was not just a woman and her family. No, there was a whole women's movement behind her in each country. In the Philippines, my organization supported the Filipino comfort women. You know, in China, they had a group of lawyers that supported the comfort women. You know, so there were different groupings that supported it, but it expanded. You know, it started to include lawyers, you know, and that became a challenge for us because this, I'm talking about 93, 94, because we were going to Japan. So what we did actually is we started legal cases in Japan. So in 94, we filed a case in the Tokyo District Court, because then during that period, there was no, you know, statute of limitations in Japan. So we are able to file a case in the Japanese court. So in the Philippines, we filed the case in behalf of the Filipino comfort women led by Tomasa Salinog. China also filed a case. You know, North Korea filed a case, South Korea, Taiwan. So we all started filing cases in the different district courts in Tokyo and outside of Tokyo. What happened to the case? I mean, there were really formal cases with judges and our Japanese lawyers. So, by the way, gave their services pro bono. We never paid them. They felt that it was their responsibility to ensure that justice be done to women. And so they traveled to the Philippines on their own funding, their own personal costs, and all the Japanese hearing and legal researches done in Japan was pro bono. So the cases, we started losing in the district court, and then we brought it to the appeals court. I think in the fantastic article of Chea, she did mention for a while that the Yamaguchi court did recognize the case, but eventually it fell to the court of appeals. In the case of Tomasa Salino, which I led in the filing of the cases, we went all the way to the Supreme Court. Yeah, we really brought the case with Attorney Yokota all the way to the Supreme Court. Of course, you know, you're accusing the very government that you are, you know, fighting. And of course, we all lost the case. But look at this from this standpoint. It was not losing the case in one sense. You lost it from the legal court proceedings, right? That's one thing. But the international support to the case of the comfort women, and more importantly, the Japanese awareness on the case of the comfort women was immeasurable. You know, we would go from one city to another and you have 200, 300 Japanese in one hall listening to the comfort women. It was very emotional, you know. They would come in and cry with the women and they would apologize to the women that this happened during the war, you know. So it was another level of movement that came out of Japan, of which they call themselves the perpetrator country, and they call us the victimized countries. You know, that's how we refer to each other. Oh, we have to talk to the victimized countries, you know, and they are the perpetrator country. This is how the Japanese activists would refer themselves in our, you know, communications. But there was so much passion and movement, and mostly from the activists in Japan and mostly lawyers. I have to say mostly, like all of you, they were really lawyers from Tokyo University, Nagoya University, all these universities. They really joined us, and private lawyers who are well known in Japan, you know, they have big offices, they supported the case. So that movement for us is a winning, you know. Then of course the comfort women went to CNN and BBC and all of this, you know, New York Times and all these national and international newspapers. So the case was there. Then in, may I continue? Yeah. Then in, I think it was in 1998, I was involved in I was part of what we call the Women's Caucus for Gender Justice that lobbied to the International Criminal Court. This was the time when the International Court is being established, you know. So I was also at that time part of the group of women. There were around 15 of us women, mostly women lawyers, you know, but we women lawyers and activists mixed together that we wanted to influence the gendered construction of the ICC. Yeah, so we were in Rome during the establishment of the International Criminal Court. We lobbied, during the Assembly of State Parties on how to integrate rape, sexual slavery, sexual violence, forced pregnancy, and gender-based violence as war crimes and crimes against humanity. So we tried to really integrate gender into the ICC, and we lobbied very hard. We were all NGOs. We didn't have money, and we had big fights with the Vatican because the Vatican tried to stop some of the issues that were pushing forward during this time. So it was really a very good time. Then we were still working on the Comfort Women. Then one day, Yoon Jung-ok from South Korea and Yayori Matsui of Japan, we came together. We were in Geneva at that time, and they said, "Inday, why don't we organize a tribunal, like a people's tribunal?" Then I told Yayori, and I said, "Yayori, if we organize a tribunal, we have to pattern the tribunal after the International Criminal Court." Because at that time, I was already involved with the ICC. So with the formation of the ICC as an activist, you know, and with a group of women who'd been lobbying there. So we agreed. And that actually, Chea, was the beginning. You know, we agreed that the Women's Tribunal will not be like a People's Tribunal or the Bertrand Russell Tribunal, but it will be a tribunal that is part of or patterned, as I would say, after the International Criminal Court. So actually, the development of the charter of the Tokyo Women's Tribunal was bloody. Yeah, it was really bloody. Why I said it was bloody? Because you have nine countries, nine prosecutors coming together from different legal framework, you know. In China had a different legal framework. North Korea had a different legal. Philippines, you know, we were former colony of the United States, so our legal framework is more patterned to the U.S. China had a different one, you know. It was really quite a challenge. So when we started drafting the charter, which will guide how the tribunal to be done, and we want it from a legal framework, the first meeting was done in Seoul, Korea. Yeah. So Patricia Sellers was there, everybody was there. And by that time, majority of the lawyers were men, actually. The lawyers in North Korea and South Korea, they were mostly men, and there were women, but the majority leaders were really men. China, you know, in the Philippines, mostly men, we got to gather together. So it was very hard to do that. Then one of the contentious point in the drafting of the charter was when we met in Taiwan. So we met four times. We met first in Seoul, Korea, then in Tokyo, in Taiwan. And finally, it was in Taiwan that it became controversial because South Korea insisted that war crimes be included, not crimes against humanity alone. They wanted war crimes. So they walked out. You know, and all the prosecutors started debating, and then they came back, and you know, the chief prosecutors were saying it would be very hard for us to propose war crimes because, you know, the war crime has different element. Yeah, as a matter of fact, China wanted to push for genocide, you know, and genocide is pretty hard. You have to have intent, you know, in the genocide. So that debate lasted for a long time. So I would just like you to recognize the fact that these are real debates by lawyers who are like really setting up a real war crimes tribunal. You know, there was walkout, the researchers were running back and forth on the sides. So it was really very intense. Then finally, we agreed in a meeting in Manila, because it was my turn to organize it in Manila, that the charter was all agreed to focus on crimes against humanity. So the preparation of the prosecution will focus on that. And that was really a hard process in coming together. But, you know, eventually we succeeded in coming together. And that is how we started the Tokyo Women's Tribunal.
Thanks so much, Inday. That's really interesting. I had no idea about all this going on behind the scenes.
Yeah.
What did you hope the tribunal would achieve? In your work, you talked about how the tribunal's aim went beyond the dramatic and that the tribunal was crucial in the shattering of myths. So I was wondering if you could talk to a little bit to us about what you think were the tribunal's legal innovations and achievements, as legal as well as non-legal.
Yeah. Well, in terms of what the tribunal has achieved, I think there were a lot of landmark cases that we have put forward. You know, even if it is legally non-binding, but we really went through the legal procedure on how a war crimes tribunal would be done. I would just like to state the fact that we had we have four judges, no? Judge Gabriel Kirk McDonald, Judge Carmen Argibay from Argentina, then we have Willie Mutunga from Kenya, and then Christine Jenkins from London. We actually asked Judge Bagwati from India, who agreed, but had a heart issue before boarding the plane, so she was not allowed. Then we asked also Vetit Montaban from Thailand to be one of the judges, but he couldn't make it as well. So if you ask why there were no Asian judges, you know, that was the only reason, but we maintained the four judges. So what was the challenges and what were the gains that we have had? I think we have to look at the tribunal as the judgment of the Tokyo Women's Tribunal as one of the most gendered interpretation of international law. And Chia told me that you have studied and have read this or have looked at it. The element leading to the tribunal, as I was saying, was all led by the lawyers. I will be sending you a video on that. Yeah, it was all done by the lawyers, you know, and how you would organize a tribunal. Now, we also have a registrar. So by the time the Philippines was the one who took the position of the registrar, so all the evidence were sealed and marked and numbered. So when you look at the process, it was not just, you know, ordinary testimonies of the women. There were evidences. Now, how did the evidence came about? And this is where the Japanese activists and lawyers became very crucial. Because as we are stating that these comfort women, for example, in the Philippines, was taken in this comfort station in this area, the Japanese researcher at the war library, you know, the war archives library, would be researching. And then they will be able to find out whether there were Japanese soldiers in this area, in this village, in the Philippines, or in China, or in South Korea. It was really a tremendous work behind it. One particular case which we brought to the Tokyo Tribunal was the mass rape of the women of Mapanique. Now, I discovered the mass rape by chance, right? One day when I was, you know, talking on the radio, one of the young men heard me talking on the radio on the case of the comfort women. Then they came to my office, literally one van full of women, and they said they were raped during the war. And so I was really taken aback. I'm talking about there were 15 women in one van who came and started testifying. They were already in their advanced age. And they told me their story. And then after that, I went to the village, which we called Mapanique, they were all raped in this big, you know, red house, they call it, but literally the house, the mansion was painted red. And that is where the rape happened. So actually, the case of the Mama Paniki was the only mass rape we brought at the tribunal. Yeah. But there was opposition in bringing that case because they were considered mass rape and not sexual slavery, you know, because they remained in the Bahay Napula, which is the name of the house. Yeah, they were all the women in the village were herded there, and then they were repeatedly raped there for 2 or 3 days, but they were not comfort women. So the South Korean objected to that, the North Korean objected to that, but eventually I prevailed because I said, you know, whether you're raped once or twice in a day, you know, the element of the crime has been committed. And this is was also what really enlightened us, because as we were going into the testimonies, and this is why it's really important to get the testimonies of the survivors and victims, yeah? Because it was through the survivors that we were able to identify the crimes, yeah? Like, for example, when we were talking, and we were always consulting the survivors on how the tribunal will be done, you know? And she said, okay, you were raped. And I remember one of the survivors was saying, no, I was not only raped, I was abducted, I was imprisoned, I was tortured. You know, and I was trafficked, and they brought me to Burma. They brought me to, what's that? I think Malaysia, I think they brought them. So the woman was saying that there was more than one crime committed against her. She was not only raped, she was not only sex slave, she was abducted, she was tortured, she was mutilated, she was trafficked. So when we were looking at it, yeah, it was not just sexual slavery. There were other crimes committed against one single woman. But all of that came out in the testimony, which really expanded our ideas when you look at the legal aspect of it. And so even now, when you look at rape cases, eventually you will have to look at rape cases. You have to look at that in a rape case, there is always more than one crime committed against the woman. It's not only rape. I'm sure she has been abducted, she has been imprisoned, she has been tortured. So all of this element of the crime happens. So the tribunal itself and the legal ramifications of the tribunal is, you know, we need another class to discuss about that. And Chaya has written beautiful article on this aspect of the work of the tribunal, which really look at why any forms of sexual violence done to women in wartime should be prosecuted. When Allied forces came to Japan and to other countries, whether the Philippines or Indonesia or wherever, yeah, they found women in those comfort stations. They actually helped them, gave them medicines and all that. But you see, there was a lack of gender understanding of the crimes. They were only looking at the men who were killed, you know, and who fought, but they were not looking at the impact of the violence of the crime. Actually, during this time, I was studying the IMFDF. There was an article in one book that one Filipina actually testified at the International Military Tribunal in San Francisco. But her case was just like, okay, there was a rape case. It was not addressed as a specific case at all. So this is very important because there's, again, you know, gender dimension to the case itself. Yeah.
Yeah, thank you very much, Indai. In your work, you also talked about how the authority of the tribunal comes from the victims, the peoples of Asia Pacific, as well as peoples of the world. The tribunal clearly took a victim or people-centered approach. So what were your experiences like working with the victim survivors? What were the hopes of the victim survivors for the tribunal? And what was their response to the tribunal and its judgment?
Yeah. Well, actually, from the beginning, we were really very victim-focused, yeah? Because as I was saying, the structure of the 9 countries, there were women's organizations behind the comfort women, whether like in East Timor, there were only to comfort women who could come to the tribunal, but there were five of them. Then you have the women prosecutors who became now, they're now in the Supreme Court in East Timor. There were women's organization who supported them. So behind every comfort women, there is a group of women's organization that supported them at different levels. Now, how did we do this? We would agree, you know, the nine country activists and lawyers would come together, and whatever is our decision on how to proceed with the tribunal, we immediately, when we go back to the country, we call for a big meeting with the comfort women, and we tell them this is the decision of the organizing committee. So they were involved. Of course, sometimes they don't understand the legal aspect of it. So we try as much as possible to explain to them. And for them at that time, it was real. It was a real tribunal. It was not, they know it's a people's tribunal, but for them, it was a real tribunal. And I think that made a lot of difference, because we kept on going back and forth to them, you know, and that they will have to testify in the tribunal, and that there will be judges, and that there will be, prosecutors to present their case. So they knew that. They were really part of this process. And I think that engagement, has really shifted the psychology of the comfort women. I remembered very well the first time Lola Rosa came to us to testify. We were sitting in the office and she was telling us her story. She was really drugged and, of course, she came from a disadvantaged position. She was poor. She was really shabby and everything. And she was crying. And she said, at last, I'm able to come out and, tell my story. And then we would be asking her to come back again to testify. After, a month or so, she started coming in. She has a new dress. She put on a lipstick. She had her hair cut. You could really shift the psychology, of her. The more, from the first testimony with, she could hardly look at us and she was shabby. And 1 month later, she was putting on a lipstick. She had a new dress. She had her hair cut and she had powder on her face. The self-confidence and self-esteem, you could see it come back from the testimony of coming out and telling their stories. So it should be empowering. We should look at these testimonies as empowering, because it really does. And we always say victims and survivors, because the survivors are alive, but some of the victims are dead, right? So you always say victims last survivors, because you have to recognize that some of the victims have died during the course of this crime. So in terms of the survivors, it's really dramatic. And I want to share with you one instance. In the 1993 public hearing, that was the first time that the comfort women from North, South Korea, the Philippines, and China and the Netherlands came together. Yeah. When one of the North Korean was testifying how she was brought to this comfort station, it was very clear which comfort station, which area, how big was the place. One of the South Korean women came on stage. She was, walking towards the stage. And then she recognized her, that they were both together in that comfort station. I tell you, we all died. We all died. We all cried so much because of how in 50 years later, you find the very same comfort women that you were together in the same comfort station. And that was, and she is now in North Korea and the other one is in South Korea. And that is why I really have to say that when we finalized the charter, this is the first time in the history that North and South Korea decided to bring their case as one country. That was really historic. And remember, North Korea will not do anything without the decision of the government. We all know that, yeah? South Korea, they're very independent. But when they decided, when they presented it to us at the organizing committee, we really clapped our hands because we were so happy. Because at that time, it was not yet, you know, divided. So they were really one Korea. So they have decided to put it within that context. And I think that's really admirable. And I hope all of you will continue to look at this issue and its historic significance. Yeah.
Yeah, thank you so much, Indai. That's really inspirational and moving. I just have one last question, and then I don't want to impose too much on your time. Then maybe I'll open it up to the floor for Q&A. What do you think should be the way forward for the movement now?
Well, thank you for that. I think that's the hardest question. moving forward, it's really important. As a matter of fact, I have to quote you, Chia, in your article, which I read a number of times, that you were recommending that it shouldn't end. You know, that, you know, we have thought about it to look at the other aspects of the tribunal, because there is so much aspect of the tribunal from a legal standpoint that we can really re-examine again and move it forward and push, you know, the, as we would say, you know, go into the fringes, you know, of international law and humanitarian law. That's what it's all about. You have to challenge and constantly challenge and make it viable for the victims and survivors, because the law, it should not be looked at as static, you know. We, you and I and you young lawyers, you should evolve those laws. You should push for it, you know, and make it more accountable to the present situation of the people and the context, you know, the culture, the traditions, all of that. You have to unpack that and really challenge it. So I think in terms of the future of the tribunal, there are several aspects of it now. For those of us who are being part of this, I said I'm planning to put the book together in the tribunal. I'm still trying to look at how we're going to do it, because it's just so immense what approach we would do. I would like to actually start on how the movement behind it really happened, because that is the most important part, you know, because the tribunal wouldn't happen without the activists and the lawyers behind it, because none of us were paid from this work. None of us. We all did it out of the passion and out of the support and love for the comfort women, you know, that they seek justice. So, you know, I think putting the documentation together, and I hope that you, all of you in this class, will support that this, the tribunal, be taught in law schools. You know, that is a very good area to look at what gender justice is all about, because, you know, with the current wars all over the world, there will be more cases like this. But I think that is where, you know, the learnings from the past really becomes important. And in terms of the legacy of the comfort women, I think that is really what they wanted to do. The reason that Kim Hak-soon came out was because she heard from the radio that the Japanese soldiers are going to Cambodia. It was part actually of the peacekeeping mission, but she thought there was a war in Cambodia. She, of course, didn't understand it. So she said, I'm coming out so that the women in Cambodia won't be raped like me. Yeah. So it was just as simple as that, but it triggered a whole movement of women coming out in different countries and really standing up. It was quite a struggle, you know. You're standing up to one of the biggest and richest country in the world, Japan, you know, and all the ramifications related to it. But, you know, and during the time when we were there, the right wing are picketing us. There were death threats to the women activists from Japan. They were threatened. Some of them couldn't go home to their houses because the right wing was very active in attacking us. Even during the tribunal, they have rally in front of the tribunal, condemning us and calling the comfort women prostitutes. Of course, the police were there, but they were there. They were always threatening, yeah, of what we're doing. But you know, when they threatened us, we counter-picked them, you know, so we didn't go away. The more they threatened us, they picked. I remember there was one time that they were on the other side of the road and we were also on the other side of the road picketing. So it's like that. You have to do your brinkmanship. That's why it's important. And I always say this, even when, you know, part of the work I do, I'm a humanitarian advisor. So I live in Iraq, in Afghanistan. I was recently in Syria and all that, looking at the issues of women. The best way to support the cases of women is to have a movement behind it, a group of women's organization, men, lawyers, sympathizers come together. You know, I mean, it was amazing how we are able to manage all those hundreds of volunteers coming together. But yes, it's important that you gather the activists and the legal minds coming together and say, let's work on this, because that's how you really go into the whole process of giving, you know, and the process is a justice process in itself. The justice is not about guilty. Yeah, it doesn't end there. Going towards that is the healing already. Yeah, that's the process. It should be empowering and healing, not only for the survivors, but also for the activists and the lawyers who were part of it.
Thank you so much, Indai. Really appreciate your insights. And I'd like to open it up now to the class for questions. You can just raise your hands and I'll call on you. Jia Ying and then Revati.
Hi, Mr. Zhao. I'm Jia Ying. I really respect and admire the hard work you put into making the Tokyo Women's Tribunal possible. I think it sounded like a really painstaking and challenging process. I actually wanted to ask about the stance of the Japanese throughout the tribunal, because this wasn't really discussed in the articles that we went through as a class. I wanted to ask about the reaction of the government towards the Tokyo Women's Tribunal before and after it happened. Was there any pushback, seeing that we did not officially recognize or endorse the TWT? Because I was actually quite surprised that they allowed it. I thought it was quite a symbolic move on their part. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Yeah, well, Jai, they were actually resistant, you know, of course, it was expected to be resistant. But I had to give it to them for allowing it. You know, they never denied me visa for one, you know, so, or denied any of us visa. They all gave visa to the comfort women. They all made, you know, when we go to the embassy and we wanted, you know, because part of our court case, they said, yes, here's your visa. But I think the important thing is that, the, you know, within the government, the right-wing movement is also to be considered, because the right-wing were really against the comfort women. They would openly call them prostitutes in all their, you know, publications, you know. But the Progressive Diet members or members of the Parliament of Japan, there were a number of them who were supportive on the case of the comfort women. They sat down with the comfort women. They had meetings with the comfort women, and we would go door to door in the parliament, meeting different congressmen and senators with the comfort women. I didn't do it alone. I never go to Japan without the comfort women with me. You know what I mean? Or even our colleagues from other countries. We always bring the comfort women because it has to be their voices to be heard. Now, the Japanese government, I remembered Prime Minister Murayama and Prime Minister Kusumi, I hope I pronounced that right, they actually acknowledge, you know, acknowledge the existence of comfort women. As a matter of fact, then Senator Murayama did meet the comfort women before he became prime minister. So when he became prime minister, we were very hopeful that he would do something. But of course, the politics in the diet is too intense for him, I think. But yes, they did acknowledge. And it was during the time Kusumi that the Japanese government did write a letter, some kind of, you know, not really apologizing, but sounded like an apology. Now, our Japanese counterpart was saying that the letter from the Japanese government was not a letter of apology, it was an atonement. you know. So there is two different things between apology and atonement. But that was in the context of the Asian Women's Fund. You know, the Asian Women's Fund was set up by the government of Japan to give $20,000 to those women, you know, who agree to, you know, to avail of the fund. But then during that time, the Japanese, our Japanese counterpart, and especially South and North Korea, they said, this is charity. They are buying the comfort women. They are not recognizing that it's a war crime. They're not recognizing of the violence that happened during the war to these women. They just want to give money and to write this atonement letter. So there was a debate, a big debate in the movement. Actually, there was a split in the movement because the South Koreans refused the Asian Women's Fund and the North Korea, but some of the Chinese comfort women took it, some of the Filipino comfort women took it, you know, so there was a big, as well as the Indonesian, so there was a big fight into a struggle, I would say. Now, this is where you have to look at the feminist lens into this, you know. From a very principled point of view, from us activists and lawyers, it is indeed atonement and it is indeed charity, right? Because they're kind of, you know, Jiang, they're literally saying, okay, we'll give you 20,000 as long as you acknowledge this, without recognizing the violence and the crime. But then again, this is the comfort women's decision. This is when we had a bit of a struggle because my position is that I believe that it's atonement, but the decision has to be done by the women themselves. Yeah, by the comfort women. So some of the comfort women took it. That was a lot of money, you know, 20,000. We have never seen that in their lifetime, in our lifetime, you know. So they want to take it. The $20,000 is a lot of money for them. So some took it, but it did. It was a struggle within the movement. Our Japanese counterparts, we have to explain to them that their decision or the lawyer's decision or our decision, it should not influence the decision of the women. So we presented it to them, the comfort women. This is the Asian Women's Fund. This is our position. We're not for it because it's charity. They don't acknowledge the violence and the crime and sexual slavery that you went through legally. And the letter that you'll receive is an atonement letter, not a letter of apology. We explained it really by details to all the comfort women. Each country does it on their own. We have guidelines how to explain it. Then you decide. So, but as I was saying, it was a struggle and quite a process, yeah, that the Korean refused to accept it. Yeah.
Thanks very much, Indai. We have another question from Revity.
First of all, just thank you so much for that talk. I think as a woman who works a lot in the UK on women's human rights and wants to continue that on an international level, I think there's like a degree of thanks I really want to give to you for creating such a big foundation for that. Mm-hmm. My question is, though, obviously this tribunal involved a lot of governments and survivors from East Asian countries, and you've spoken a lot about the gender dimensions of this, but I was wondering, do you think that there's an element of ethnicity and culture that played a role in the initial lack of justice for the survivors and then any subsequent reactions to the tribunal, especially because the tribunal served as such a foundation for the international women's rights networking? Do you think that such a tribunal could have occurred in another region with the same impact it had?
Mm, very good question. Well, we decided to do it in Japan because that is where it really happened, you know, that's where a perpetrator country. So we did at one point thought that we should do the tribunal in another, you know, country, as, you know, to, especially to a victimized country. But the point is we decided to do it in Japan because that is a perpetrator country and we are putting them accountable for their, you know, the crimes they have committed against the comfort women. So we did focus on doing it in Japan. Now, if you have seen the tribunal, we also asked the Japanese government to come present their case to the tribunal. It's known as the amicus curiae from a legal point of view, but they didn't. So we asked a very prestigious, well-respected lawyer in Japan. He is like an old, he is like the icon of all the lawyers in Japan to do the amicus curiae. So we really have to get someone who is well-recognized by both the government and the activists as the one to present the amicus curiae, which is called Friends of the Court, but to put the side of Japan. For a while, actually, as I was saying, because this was very ASEAN in context, East and Southeast Asia, we really wanted to bring it to, as I was saying, to one of the Asian countries, but that was not really considered. But what was good in the tribunal was we even went to all the countries. All of us organizers, we went to China, we went to North Korea, we went to South Korea, we went to Taiwan, we went to the Philippines, of course, and Malaysia, and you know, all of this. I think there must be someone from Singapore at that time who joined us, but we visited all the countries. So that's a very good question, because when we visited, we would have the big meetings there. The comfort women will be, the national comfort women in those countries would be joining us, and then we would have press conference. So we are always on the media as well. So yeah, that was the approach with it, yeah, in localizing or nationalizing the issue.
Any other questions? Sophie and then Aish.
Yeah.
Without an official apology, do you think that the tribunal was enough to provide the victim survivors with a sense of justice?
No. Well, for us, the tribunal itself, you know, was the sense of justice that was given to the comfort women. You know, when the judgment was handed down in Tokyo, and that, you know, Emperor Hirohito was declared guilty in the context of command responsibility on the case of what happened during the Second World War, all the comfort women went on stage and they started crying and hugging each other. You know, we all cried as well, you know, because during that time, one can really see that justice was happened, you know, during the handed down, when the judges handed down the judgment, the women knew that they won the case, that their stories were acknowledged, that they were right to speak it out. And so, yeah, that sense of justice was immeasurable. I remembered one of the comfort women, Tomasa Salino, when she was interviewed, she said, "I can die now because I have seen justice in my lifetime," you know. So for them, it was justice, because they have all these people around the world coming together to the tribunal and supporting them. And you have all these legal, well-known people from different countries coming together to really look at the legal dimension of why it was a crime against humanity. So this is where what sense of justice really means, you know, like, you know, you have to examine what sense of justice is. And this is what the comfort women has taught us, that the tribunal did not only give them a sense of justice, but a sense of justice does not come about just the guilty, you know, or being pronounced guilty. You know, I think many of you have read cases of women who were raped, you know. When you ask what is their sense of justice, some of them, they want to kill the man. They want to kill the one who raped them. Some of them want to bring the case to court. Some of them don't have anything to do with them. So you redefine your own sense of justice to a certain degree while still looking at the legal aspect of the crime committed against you. So in the case of the comfort women, that was really a real sense of justice for them when the judgment was handed down. By the way, we have two levels, no? We did a judgment in Tokyo and the final judgment came 1 year later, which we did in The Hague. Now, I think it's very important for you to know why we flew all the way to The Hague and did the final judgment there, where the thick judgment was given. Because after the tribunal and the initial judgment was done in Tokyo, the lawyers and the, you know, have to come back again with the judges to write the final judgment. That took 1 year, and we did it in The Hague because The Hague is the seat of the you know, International Criminal Court and other war crimes tribunals. So we also wanted to officialize it in The Hague.
Question from Aish. I think there's a last question. Aish?
Firstly, thank you so much for giving your talk. We learned a lot from it. And it's really interesting how all these years there hasn't been a feminist take on international law. So yes. On this matter, I just have two questions. So my first question is that like one thing that I found really interesting while reading the judgment was that it kind of topples the whole idea of Westphalia, which has been present in international law for very long, because in one part of the judgment, it said that this is not, I think with relation to the peace treaties, it said that it is not up to states, but it is up to the peoples. Yeah. So firstly, in your opinion, given how this shakes up the whole Westphalian model of international law, how well do you think this will be perceived by states and in the future in the international arena? And my second question is that, you know, the thing with these comfort women is that they are old right now and yeah. A lot of them have died. So given how the whole comfort women issue, as acknowledged in the judgment itself, it's not just for the survivors, but it also trickles down to their families and it has like continuing effects on the community. So even after the death of the survivors, what do you think will be the future of this movement in respect of like reparations?
Mm-hmm. Well, I'll answer the last verse in response to the reparations coming from Japan. That would not be possible. I think we did what we can in pushing Japan to give reparations to the comfort women, but I don't see that really happening, you know, because of the fact that they have already taken the position from the very beginning of the movement not to give reparation because of the San Francisco Treaty. But, you know, we have shamed them in many ways. But more importantly, it's just the international acknowledgement of the crime that was committed against women and how it inspired other women to come out and tell the story of what happened to them during the war and continues to this day, by the way. So that for us is one of the biggest legacy of the comfort women in codifying sexual slavery, but more so in challenging international law, which comes to your first question. I think we have to constantly challenge all the laws for that matter. We should not look at it as static, you know. We have to evolve it. We have to really look at what are the other finer points that makes it easier for the people to seek justice. Because all the laws in our land, it's just so hard to prove. I mean, like even to prove rape for me, you know, I will be honest with you, in some situation, I would tell the women not to bring their rape cases to court because it victimizes the women again, you know, and the trauma that goes with it. So it's really hard. You know, when I was in Iraq for a long time, I was there with the UN and we were looking at the case of the Yazidi women who were, you know, raped and made into sex slaves by the ISIS. Yeah, you must have read about that. They really had a hard time because their culture is so close to be able to say what happened to them, you know, and more so bring that to court. But it took courage, you know, and shift. And dismantling the patriarchal structure of their communities because the men did not allow them to speak. It was the women who said, no, we want to speak. You know, so it was really hard. We have to convince their heads of their communities to allow the women. You know, there was intervention from the UN that you have to allow the women because their culture will not allow it. So, you know, you're breaking cultures, you're breaking traditions, while at the same time you're challenging international human rights law to be more responsive to women, because majority of the crimes that happens during the war are done to women. I have seen that now, not only in the comfort women, but I have lived in other countries that I have seen that women are most of the victims. Yeah, all of it, most of it. So that is our challenge. And I think your generation will be able to bring it to another level. I think so. Yeah.
Indai, we have just one more question from Haida here. Is that okay? I've imposed a lot of time. Yes.
Yeah, no, yes, of course.
Hi. Thank you so much for the talk, and also thank you for all the work that you have done, most notably in the Tokyo Women's Tribunal and also in other countries of conflict. So my question is, when the International Organizing Committee or the IOC issued an invitation to Japan to participate in the proceedings and the hearing of the tribunal, when the government of Japan didn't respond, what was the IOC's reaction, and did it come as a surprise?
Thank you. Very good question. Well, when we did the Japanese government, we did that formally. Huh? We really sent a formal letter to the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. The three of us conveners signed, Yoyori Matsui, Yun Jung-wook, and myself. We formally signed the letter as conveners of the tribunal. And when we got the response, we were kind of expecting that they won. We were not surprised, yeah? But, you know, remember that when we send the letter to the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, we have Diet members, you know, members of the Japanese Senate and Congress who were with us in saying, do it, we will try our best to push them, you know. But we knew that they will say no. But the effort and the process towards it is important. And that is why we resorted to the amicus curiae. Yeah. Now, in coming to the amicus curiae, that was also a challenge for us, because we need to get someone who is respected by the government, you know, and at the same time, by the lawyers. So he has to be a well-known Japanese lawyer in Japan that is respected by the Japanese government. And because he has to write his own amicus curiae, we are not writing it for him, and by the lawyers in Japan. So after a lot of recommendations from the Japanese lawyers, because they would know who, then we did. So we have to wait for their recommendation. We ended up, I forgot his name. He's a very old man. Not very old, but he's an old man, white hair, but very well respected in Japan, you know. It was really funny, because when the Japanese lawyers went to see him about doing the amicus curiae, he turned them down. He said, no, I won't do it. Yeah. And then what happened was that when we're having the IOC meeting in Japan, and they said, he is the best one we can find, because he's very well respected by the government, and a lot of law firms in Japan, you know, the hierarchy of the law firms in Japan is really amazing, you know. And it's very male dominated. He said, he's the one. If we get him, you know, we will be able to succeed, you know, because of his independence. And he's very well respected. But he said no to the Japanese lawyers. You know, a delegation of Japanese lawyers went to see him, and he said, no, I won't do it. So Yayori Matsui, Yun Jung-wook, and I decided to see him. Yeah. And we went to his office just to say, you know, we heard it. Anyway, he agreed. The moment he saw three women in front of him, we were able to convince him to do the amicus curiae. So, and that is why we got him. And we were really happy with him, because he did write his own paper and he delivered it. So that was really good. Yeah. We gave him the independence to do that. Yeah. So
I'm so sorry, but we have one last question from Xue Yi. Is it okay for you to take it?
Hi, Indai, can you hear me?
We.
Okay. First of all, I wanted to say that I really appreciate that how your work includes hearing out every testimony of each of the comfort women and making sure that their individual voices are heard. Earlier, you mentioned that, you know, you had to reconcile each individual comfort woman's sense of justice, which of course can be different from her fellow survivors, with the legal aspects of the case overall. So considering that, of course, everybody will have a different idea of what they want out of the tribunal, how was the process like in explaining to them how the tribunal and having the tribunal held in a certain way, like you mentioned, would actually help to meet their collective need for justice, and then making sure that they individually also felt satisfied with the outcome of the tribunal?
Yeah, very good question. Because as I was saying, from the beginning, we were really looking at that justice, that sense of justice for the comfort women. And of course, none of these comfort women, they come from the villages in the Philippines, the villages in China, they came from, you know, and some of them just didn't even reach high school, you know, they have children and grandchildren. So it was very different, you know, the comfort women come from different status in their societies, in our societies. But explaining to them the tribunal was really a task for all of us, that we have to always tell them what it was all about. Yeah. And so I think later on in your lawyers, you have to discuss this with your clients and explain blow by blow what would happen and how the case would do. So, and I think because we did that, Chewy, it became very real to them, because it was not just the activists coming and telling them, we brought Filipino lawyers to the villages and well-known Filipino lawyers. The dean of the College of Law became one of our lawyers from the University of the Philippines, came to these villages. We had, you know, lawyers in well-dressed that they know their lawyers explaining the whole thing to them, you know, and they did that in China as well, in Korea, in Indonesia. So all of us did that. We documented this explaining. We report back to the organizing committee what was the response of the comfort women, how they look at it. And that was when I discussed with you about the different crimes, that for every one woman, there was more than one crime. Because when we say, we will, you know, put your case on sexual slavery, and the women would say, no, but I was also tortured. They abducted me. They brought me to another country, as in the case of the Korean comfort women. They traveled with the troops to different countries. They went to Burma, they went to Malaysia. They traveled with the troops. So, you know, that was really important, that help us gather also that level of understanding on their case and how we are going to translate that into legal terms with them. And of course, it was quite hard, but, you know, we come from a society that we really respect lawyers, you know, that what the lawyers say is almost like a law. So they listen to the lawyers. And when the lawyers say, this is what we'll do for you and how it will be done, and we have to fly you to Tokyo. Remember, some of these women never left their villages, more so than flying them all the way to Tokyo, you know. So these are really different experiences for them. So, yeah, we really went through that. And your point, Chiwe, on the sense of justice, one of the things that we also realized, because we met the members of their families, you know, their husband is there, you know, their children are there, they are all, some adult children and grandchildren. When we go to their houses, they're all over sitting, listening to us as well. And we have big meetings with their families, you know, the families and the husband would say, you know. But we realized that, you know, when a woman is raped, she is not the only one who suffers. You know, her husband suffer, her children suffer, her parents suffer, the community suffers for everyone raped. because when we were listening to the Comfort Women, then the husband would say how it affected him. The parents would say how it affected them, or they will describe if the parents are dead, how it affected the father and the mother. And then when one of the Comfort Women told her son that she was raped during the war, the son didn't talk to him for 3 months, you know. So the effect of one violence done to women is multiplied. It's not only her who suffers, the whole family and the community suffers. So that sense of justice that they got, the family also got that, you know. So it's not an individual, it's a collective sense of justice. Because later on, the son who refused to talk to the mother, he would go around and said, "My mom won the case in Tokyo." Yeah. In the village of Mapaniki, the mayor came, the governor came, because the women won the case of Tokyo, and the governor had a party, you know, for them, gave them gifts and all that, you know. So the whole villages, you know, came about that sense of justice, you know. The in one province in Antique, the governor decided to put a museum for the case of Lola Masing in the city hall, you know, and because she won the case in Tokyo, you know. So all of that, not only the women, but the whole village, the governors, the mayors of the city where they came from, they were all announced that she won the case in Tokyo. So that's important. Yeah.
Indai, I'm so appreciative of you taking your time, giving us your time. So on behalf of the class and myself, thank you once again. And I hope that our conversations can continue. What I'm going to do is I'm going to get your talk transcribed, and I'll send you a copy. So maybe you could include it in your book. It can be helpful for the movement in some way. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Thank you very much. Yeah.
Yeah. Nice meeting you all. It's a pleasure, really.
Thank you for joining us at the Asian Society of International Law 101, and watch this space for future conversations.